You're listening to the Untaming podcast.
Rewild the Child.
Here is your host, Emily.
Welcome back to season two of the Untaming podcast. This is episode 17 with Dr. Ray McClanahan, a barefoot podiatrist. And just quietly, this is one of my personal favourites. There was one question I forgot to ask Dr. Ray, so I emailed him afterwards and he replied with an answer that I'll read out for you now. The question was, do you have any insight into what environmental influences cause feet to turn out sideways rather than pointing straight ahead? And his reply was as follows. The greatest environmental influence on outturned feet, out-toed gait, is the tapered toe boxes included on most shoes available for humans. The tapered toe boxes position the big toe joints in partially dislocated configurations, which will not allow the feet to naturally benefit from pronation. Rather, the feet will pronate beyond their natural range of motion and for a longer period of the gait cycle. Eventually, one of the components of pronation, abduction, becomes apparent and habitual, and the feet turn out. Pronation is a combination of forefoot dorsiflexion, rear foot eversion, and forefoot abduction. There are also structural and developmental issues which cause the feet to be turned out. These can happen at multiple joint levels: hip, femur, knee, tibia, ankle, foot, or combinations at several joints. There are neurological problems that will also manifest in outturned feet. Furthermore, biomechanist Katie Bowman taught me the concept of mimicking our caregivers and profile photographs of children standing more like their parents the older they got. So there you have it. Ray was also kind enough to send me out a pair of his invention Correct Toes, which I have been wearing regularly. They're surprisingly comfortable and fit well in my wildling barefoot shoes, which my parents bought me. I like how they put my little toes back into their proper alignment. It's not something I've ever really noticed before, but now whenever I remove the correct toes, there's this subtle feeling of disappointment in those toes. And with regular wear, they will regain that strength to go back to their natural alignment on their own. Now, here is a message from our sponsor. I hope you enjoyed the last episode with Nicolette Souder on wild schooling. The next episode airing on the 28th of June is with Jen Philpott of Born Ready, a bioinformatics scientist by trade, but a baby pottying expert by experience. But for now, here is Dr. Ray McClanahan. Fifty-three-year-old Dr. Ray McClanahan was born in Port Angeles, Washington, and currently lives in Portland, Oregon. He has two teenage daughters. He completed his undergraduate studies at Liberty University in Virginia and continued his studies of podiatric medicine in Philadelphia and Portland. Dr. McClanahan has learned that most foot problems can be corrected by restoring natural foot function. He is able to help patients using this knowledge at his practice, Northwest Foot and Ankle in Portland. Dr. McClanahan is also the inventor of Correct Toes, silicone toe spaces that help the foot rehabilitate from the negative effects of conventionally shaped footwear. On top of all of this, Ray is an active runner and athlete. In 1999, he finished 14th in the US National Men's Cross Country Championships. He then qualified for the World Duathlon Championships in 2001. Last night, Ray had about 7 hours of sleep, and he did not have lunch today because he is practicing intermittent fasting. Ray, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Emily, for having me. It's a pleasure.
So I bought my first pair of Vibram 5 fingers for running nearly 10 years ago, and despite the staring and the laughing from other people, they're still the only running shoes I use, and I've enjoyed continuing to learn about
the natural movement of the foot since then. So I really wanted to talk to you because you're an active runner, but you're also a podiatrist and a barefoot podiatrist at that. Can we begin with you telling us what initially sparked your interest in podiatry?
You bet. I was always an active kid. I loved all the sports that they allowed, but something about running really appealed to me. And in 1984, I saw the movie Chariots of Fire. And that movie moved me so deeply emotionally that I decided I was going to try to go to the Olympics for the United States of America. And so I bought my first pair of proper running shoes, and I started trying to eat really good and train good. But almost immediately, I had an injury. And I went off to the orthopedic doctor, and it happened to be my knees were hurting me. And I didn't really get any direction in terms of why I got hurt. I got a lot of treatment. And during that time, I was also running a lot of road races, and I met a gentleman who was a sports podiatrist who invited me to his practice. I got to see what he did. So that's what kind of prompted my desire to study podiatry, was sort of selfishly from my own troubles that I had had, not only prior to college, but all during college, I was mostly in the training room with some sort of injury. So it's mostly just a desire to learn more about how the body functions, not only so that I can keep running my whole life, but to try to help other people move well in their bodies as well.
Can you tell us what a natural human foot looks like when it has not been affected by environmental influences?
You bet, Emily. In fact, that's my very favorite thing to talk about. In fact, if you were to come visit us in Portland, the very first thing we do when we meet with new folks is I hold up both of my daughter's footprints at birth. And I'm not sure what they do over there in Australia, but here in America, we take the baby footprint, we put some ink on it, and we put it on the birth certificate. And it's interesting because I've looked at thousands of babies' feet, and I've only ever seen one set of baby feet that didn't have a straight big toe and weren't widest at the tips of the toes. So the very first thing we talk about is how we all come into the world. And the second thing that we talk about is I show my baby shoe that is actually shaped like a natural human foot, widest at the tips of the toes. But then we begin the process of talking about what we do with our footwear from about age 2 to 3 onward in our lives that actually detracts from natural foot anatomy. I had the pleasure of growing up in Liberia, West Africa, where most of the people didn't own shoes. And when we played soccer, my friends didn't have soccer shoes, so they ran barefoot across gravel, and it didn't bother them. So I remember thinking back then how remarkably capable their feet were. But I also remember noticing back then, and I've since subsequently noticed it around the world, cultures that don't wear shoes like ours or wear something like a Vibram Five Fingers or go barefoot or wear a flip-flop, their foot will look exactly like a baby foot throughout their whole lives. In other words, the tips of the toes will be the widest part of the foot. So once I share that with the new patients that come in, I show the footprints, I show the healthy baby shoe. We then begin talking about the metal measuring device that we use in America. I'm not sure if you guys use that in Australia. It's called the Brannock.
Yeah.
So you're familiar with it. So you stand out in the store, you get the length of your foot, which holds some value. You get the length of sometimes be helpful. But then this is where the problem.
Can I just pause you there?
You bet.
Sorry, you just cut out a little bit.
Oh, so once we outline what the shape of the foot should be, I point out to folks that if they get measured on that metal measuring device, the width of their foot will be at the ball of their feet. That's the letter that you get from the system, the C, D, E, double E, triple E, etc. What I then mentioned to folks is brand new information for most people, which is the Brannock device is not intended to fit footwear for athletics or for performance. It's actually designed to fit fashion footwear. And most of the people that come to see me aren't there because they're runway models or they want to look their best. They're there because they like to run or they like to ride their bike or they like to hike. And so for those people, the fashion features aren't nearly as important as the natural features. So beyond that, it would be for your foot to be positioned exactly like it is in your Vibram Five Fingers, which is exactly like your foot would be in its barefoot state. So in other words, your heel bone should always be flat and level with all of your other toe bones.
Right.
But when you start looking at most shoes that are available for, you know, 2 and 3 year olds, we are not only pinching the toes to be narrower than the ball, we begin lifting the back of the arch, the heel bone, higher than the front of the foot. And then we also add a feature called toe spring, where the ends of the toes get held above the ball of the foot. Mm. And so, unfortunately, our feet are pretty compensatory, so they will allow us to hold them in those malpositions literally for decades before they'll give people any problems. And that's a big part of the problem there, is that people can put on a lot of different styles of shoes that do things to their feet, and it might not immediately hurt them, which leads them to a false sense of security that, you know, lots of different shoes are fine. Mm. But in my experience, eventually it catches up to most people, and usually it's in the middle part of our lives.
Right, yeah. The first thing that sparked my interest in foot development was, I must have been a teenager, and someone told me that you should never put shoes on a baby until they're properly walking, otherwise it affects their ability to walk naturally. Does this relate to kind of what you've just said?
Absolutely does, and that's absolutely true. There's a video circulating the internet right now that shows a mother walking with her child. The baby might be 1 year old, just learned how to walk. Mm. And the mom puts on a pair of Nike shoes, or actually first the mom walks the child down this nice soft dirt path in the child's bare feet. Mm. And the child kind of has a wider base of gait. So for the audience, the feet are a little bit farther apart, the shoulder. He's got his hands up a little bit higher, trying to get his balance. And he walks down the path with mom just fine. Then they go back to the start of the path again, and she puts on a pair of Nike fashion athletic shoes for kids and walks the child down the same path. And immediately the child's base of gait gets wider and his arms go up higher, and then he falls. Mm. If we can let children develop their neuromuscular capability, they're going to be better for it throughout their whole lives. But we don't. Most of the time, we've got things on their feet early on in their life, even when they're inside of a controlled environment, which doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Okay, this next question is a bit of a two-prong question, so please bear with me. A quick Google search told me that children don't develop the arch in their feet until they're close to 6 years old. And then continuing on from that, my only real life experience with a podiatrist is when I was about 11. My sisters and I were all taken to see a podiatrist, and we were all diagnosed as having flat feet and issued with custom-made orthotics. Mm. But my youngest sister would have only been 6 at the time, and to already be diagnosed with flat feet at that age makes me wonder if there is a critical period for natural foot development in those first 6 years while the arch is still developing, when maybe the feet are more susceptible to the damage caused by conventional footwear?
Absolutely. In fact, I noticed in the pre-show email that you sent me, you're interested in talking about Dr. William Rossi, which I think it would be a great individual for your audience to hear about. But you're absolutely right. It is a critical time in the development of a child's life, and I would suggest it even goes beyond that. Some of the bones won't be skeletally mature till teenage years. Mm. A lot of children's feet are on the flat. When you look at them, they look flat, and it doesn't necessarily mean the arch is flat. And to my way of thinking, you and your sisters probably were done a disservice by inhibiting the natural development of your arches. Mm. And this is what I learned from Dr. Rossi. He spent years as a shoe industry consultant speaking to kids' shoe companies and so forth. But he was always up against well-intentioned podiatrists and orthopedic doctors, and even mom and dad and grandpa and grandma that look at a foot think it's flat and want to put something up under it. Mm-hmm. But to your point, Emily, we're actually, in my opinion, harming the children by placing an interface between their foot and the ground. And one of the ways of looking at this, in my opinion, would be that our feet are sensory organs just like our hands are. And the more things that we put between our feet and the ground, the more it's going to inhibit good sensory information, movement patterns, balance, and so forth. So, I think children should be barefoot as often as possible. And when they can't be completely barefoot, I recommend shoes that are like bare feet. Yeah. But you mentioned having a good experience in Vibrounds, and that's a good brand. But fortunately, we're living in a good time of life because there's a lot of people that are interested in making healthier footwear for kids and for adults right now. But you're absolutely right. We shouldn't be propping up arches, and we should really let people develop naturally. Because the other thing that's been shown repeatedly is it's not the structure of the arch that predicts disability. In fact, there are cultures throughout the world that have very flat appearing arches, but they also happen to be the best marathon runners in the world. Mm. So this idea that we can look at somebody's arch when they're young and predict how they're going to do, I don't think is substantiated by the medical literature.
Right. Do orthotics serve any purpose then?
They absolutely do. But the folks that they serve a purpose for, in my estimation, are rare individuals. And I can give you a couple of examples, but let me step back briefly and mention to you in the audience, I worked for an orthotics lab here in America for 5 years, Northwest Podiatric Labs. They also make the over-the-counter product called Superfeet, which you guys probably have in Australia. And then I read the work of Dr. William Rossi in 1999, which helped me to understand that most of our shoes are deforming people and changing the natural shape of their foot. So I ended up resigning from that position, mostly because I noticed that orthotics have to be made to fit into the shoes that are in the marketplace. And if the shoes are in the marketplace are not the size or not the shape of a natural human foot, I don't think two wrongs are going to make a right. So the kind of person that orthotics are going to be helpful for are two different kinds of individuals. And one of the pre-show notes you put in the email was people that have very hyper flexible soft tissues. Mm-hmm. And those are individuals, in my estimation, that you can get them very strong and you can position them naturally. And just because of the way their body's made, they might not function as well as somebody who has robust soft tissues. But let me give an example of probably the best orthotic success story that I have in my practice. It's a massage therapist that works on her feet for many hours a day. She kept tearing the tendons on the outside of her ankle, those known as the peroneal tendons for the audience. Mm-hmm. And after she tore them the second or the third time, somebody reasoned with her that there's something else going on with your body that you keep tearing these tendons. And so she and I had a visit together, and she actually has a structural deformity of the bones of the middle part of her foot. But again, this is rare. And the kind of deformity that this lady has, the front of her foot is tilted downward towards the floor more than the outside part of her foot. So we made her an orthotic that relatively levels out the outside part of her foot with the inside part of her foot so that she can walk straight and so that her arch doesn't keep tearing her tendons. I see her every 6 or 7 years make a brand new pair of orthotics. She does great. But without those orthotics, she would keep tearing her tendon and keep having repeated surgery. So There absolutely are people that need to have orthotics. Unfortunately, I think many people are told what you and your sisters were told early on in life. In fact, in podiatry across the world, it's a multi-billion-dollar industry. And so when I share some of my work with my podiatry colleagues, in fact, one in particular I shared some of my work with previously, he said, well, I really appreciate your work and I really have seen some merit, but I'm not going to make any profit selling your correct toes. I can make $1,000 selling a pair of orthotics. And so the economics of it also, I think, encourage people to prescribe them more often than they should be prescribed.
What then can people do if they have flat feet to strengthen their arches, especially for children?
Yeah. Very best thing is to go barefoot. Mm-hmm. There are some really great studies that just came out. One of them just came out a year ago. And I could send you a link by email after we speak today.
Please,
but they actually did have people went barefoot and then some people that went in minimal shoes and then compared them to people that went in just the average shoe. And there's about 7 or 8 such studies that show that if we go barefoot or we go in a shoe like the Vibram 5 Fingers, our arch muscles will get about 10% bigger.
Oh.
Yeah. And so the very best thing that you could do for kids or for anybody in particular is to just start taking the shoes off and start walking around. Those muscles will engage and they will get stronger. But then it's not a matter of you have to be barefoot all the time to make these gains. When you can't be barefoot, we recommend that people try to find a shoe that holds their foot as if it's bare inside of a covering. So in other words, it wouldn't pinch the toes, it wouldn't lift the heel, it wouldn't lift the toes, it wouldn't be stiff, it wouldn't be heavy. So just choosing shoes that are shaped like natural human feet is probably the very best thing that I could offer anybody. And when people speak Get Stronger, they do much better. We did a video on this. It's a short 5 or 6 minute video that you might want to link to. It's called Pronation versus Overpronation.
Okay, yep.
And for the audience members, pronation is another way of saying a flat foot. It's another way of saying a collapsed arch. But there's several different types of flat feet. Some are harmful and some are not. And the kinds that are not, you don't want to prop them up with an orthotic. But basically what I show in that video is I show my own foot being held in the position that a conventional athletic shoe will hold it in. And so again, for the audience, that will be higher in the heel. The ends of the toes will be above the ball of the foot with the toe spring. The tips of the toes will be squeezed narrower than the ball. And you'll see from that video that when we hold our foot like that and we bear weight on that, our arch wants to flatten out or it wants to pronate. I correspondingly, in the same video, take my own foot and I put it into natural position, which is for my heel bone, one end of my arch, to be flat and level with all the rest of the front of my foot. But most importantly, I get my big toe out wider than the ball of my foot, and then I try to flatten my foot again. And I'm hoping that your audience members can try this test at home, because this is a very viable way of determining whether or not there is something actually wrong with your arch, or whether or not your arch muscles got weak and your foot got used to positioning itself like shoes would position it. And in my practice in Portland for 25 years, I would say that 95% of the people that I've seen, when we position them naturally and get their big toe out where it belongs, their arch pronates to neutral and not beyond. Because we do need a certain amount of arch flattening and a certain amount of pronation. That's healthy and normal. But the way most shoes are built to push our big toe over towards our second toe encourages almost everybody listening to this podcast to do more pronation or more arch flattening than they would if their feet were naturally positioned and if their feet were strong.
You mentioned before about the bones in the foot often not being developed until the teenage years. So I guess that's when they're growing into their adult body. What about teenagers who are maybe taller than average or heavier than average? Do they need more foot support? I'm saying that with like air quotes.
I would say that height probably doesn't matter, but I would say weight sometimes does matter. However, unfortunately, right now, if a child is larger, oftentimes the orthopedist or the podiatrist will send them to get a stability shoe or a structured shoe or an anti-pronation shoe, thinking that since they have a bigger body, they're putting more forces on their soft tissues. So in other words, they'll get fitted for a shoe that's higher in the back and squeezes them up front. And that's not helpful. That's harmful. What I do think is helpful for children that are larger is to maybe have a little bit more material under their foot, but have their foot still be positioned naturally.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In the industry these days, that's called stack height. So in other words, the shoe should be flat or zero drop is the industry term. But if the child is larger, there's nothing at all wrong with having a little bit more material there. The downside of too much material, though, is it actually increases loading forces as opposed to decreasing them. So I think the most important feature for anybody, tall, short, heavy, light, a child or an adult, would be that their feet be naturally positioned. And that's where a lot of people are not actually positioned right now. A lot of people are wearing the conventional shoes and doing themselves a disservice.
What about like hiking? You know, so carrying large, heavy packs, the extra weight, I guess there's this belief that you need firm, sturdy shoes to help support the added load over uneven terrain.
I work closely with two doctors from North Carolina. They've got a company called Natural Foot Gear. And a few years back, they went over to Nepal and did a multiple week trek. And each night they would stay in the hostel and there were other people on the trip. There were not only people from all around the world, there were local people that lived there in Nepal. And they mentioned afterwards when they came back that it was the Westerners in the big, stiff, heavy boots that held their feet in unnatural positions that were all complaining about their feet and ankles and bodies at the end of the day, versus my friends who have been doing what you and I are talking about here for probably a decade, who were either wearing a sandal or a Vibram five finger, and they were completely content and comfortable at the end of the day. But the real take-home point that they mentioned to me that I thought was stunning was, and they took a picture of it, of a Sherpa carrying a 90-pound pack up these rocky trails with a flip-flop on.
Wow.
Yeah, so I think what that really points to is, unfortunately, in our attempt to support ourselves and cushion ourselves and support our arches, we end up buying footwear that holds us in positions that are not helpful. You would think if you spend more money on a shoe or a boot, it's going to be better for you. But unfortunately, I think when it comes to foot health, less is usually better.
Okay, so with flip-flops, I was kind of under the belief that they weren't so great for you, but with these Sherpas wearing them, what do you kind of have to say about flip-flops?
Yeah, I think, if you look at them, they are completely flat, so that's favorable. Mm. What's not favorable about them, in my opinion, is that you have to use your first and second toe to kind of clench the thong piece to hold them on, mm-hmm. which is why I recommend flip-flops, but I recommend from a company called Toe Socks, Toe S-O-X. They've got flip-flops that actually have a piece of cloth that goes in between each of your toes.
Ah, right. Ooh.
So instead of you gripping with your big toe and second toe, yeah, those are great. So I am a fan of flip-flops. Obviously, you got to be careful in the summertime if you're around a campfire. You know, every year some people do get burned with a fire, a log rolling out of the fire. Certainly, you're more prone to something traumatized on top of your foot. But musculoskeletally and structurally, they're actually very, very good footwear for you.
Oh, it's nice to know. Okay, so you mentioned before about soft tissue elasticity. Could you talk some more about that?
You bet. Yeah. Every once in a while, I'll meet somebody in the clinic who it's probably not just their feet that are hurting them. They have multiple joints that are uncomfortable. And I will run them through the tests that we just described a moment ago, where I have them stand in front of me and I let their big toe go where their shoes hold it. And I see how much their arches can collapse. And then I hold their big toe out in natural position. Folks that have very flexible, soft tissues, even when their big toe is in natural alignment, their arch will flatten completely to the ground. So, and there's a couple screening tests for this too. There's no laboratory tests. These are conditions like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is one of them. Marfan syndrome is another. And these people just, they don't put their collagen together very well. So they're every element of their body, their skin, their joints, their muscles, their ligaments, it's all just very loose. And so we have to be really careful with those people. Fortunately, they're rare. But those are another subset of people that we might actually benefit them by not only getting them into natural footwear and strengthening them, but some of those people are actually going to need some external aid. And those would be the people that would fall into the 5% of my patient population that probably is going to be using an orthotic at least part of the time, if not indefinitely.
Hmm. I guess I've heard a lot of people put these sort of issues like flat feet and bunions down to genetics. Mm. But does this have more to do with this soft tissue elasticity?
It sure does. And I'm so grateful you asked that, Emily, because we're currently in a debate right now with a group of Harvard researchers who published a paper not long ago. We have a big study going on out in Massachusetts called the Framingham Study. It's 85,000 people. They've been following them for years, looking at who gets diabetes, who gets heart disease, who gets cancer. They recently looked at what the average leg length is for all 85,000 of those people. And they also recently identified 2,700 of those 85,000 that have bunions and what the authors called digital deformities. So those are things like hammer toes and claw toes and mallet toes. Mm-hmm. And so they took those 2,700 people and they said, go back in your family tree and start talking to your relatives and find out who else has these problems. And sure enough, most people in those families of the 2,700 had similar problems. So they published in Arthritis Care and Research that bunions and digital deformities are highly hereditable. But what they failed to do was they failed to control for footwear. Hmm. So in other words, what they didn't do is what we do in our clinic every day, which shows people that bunions are not hereditary. We have people pull the removable sock liner that comes out of their shoe. And so for your audience members, this is called an insole or sock liner. It's just that little piece of foam. Yeah. But when you stand on that, anybody in the audience listening who has a bunion is going to notice that their foot is going to be wider than that sock liner mm-hmm. or that insole. So we challenged the researchers and we wrote a rebuttal and we contacted them and we said, there are two features that are hereditable in terms of bunion deformity. And one of them is super flexible soft tissues like we just talked about. Those people will be deformed by a shoe much quicker than somebody who's built a little bit more robustly.
Right.
But the other thing that we mentioned is if they took 100% of those 2,700 people and had them do the sock liner test, we would see that 100% of those people have feet that are wider than the shoes they've been wearing their whole lives. So that's what's hereditable. It's not the development of a progressive dislocation of your big toe. It's the fact that all the shoes available for all those people and their ancestors this has been going on for 400 years, Emily.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a one-to-one relationship with the tapering toe box of the shoe. So we did a three-part blog post on this very thing. It's on our website. It's called The Hereditary Bunion Myth, Part 1, 2, and 3. And we reasoned with the researchers that if we employed their methodology to come to their conclusion, we could similarly go to Thailand where the ladies wear rings on their neck and make long necks, and we could say, wow, look at all these ladies with long necks. It must be heredity.
Mm.
Or we could go to Africa where they take the little child at birth and bandage the skull to make a cone-shaped skull. And we could say, well, geez, cone-shaped skulls are prevalent in the society. But obviously, the prudent person recognizes the external deforming force, which in the case of bunions is always tapered toe box footwear.
Mm.
In other words, when I grew up in Africa, I didn't see the bunions. I've been to South America. They're not in the jungles. They're in the cities, but they're not in the jungles. I've been to Asia. As soon as you start seeing cultures that wear what we wear, you're going to see bunions, and you're going to see all the other stuff that I'm trained to treat. So no, they're not. The bunions are a progressive dislocation of our big toes caused by tapering toe boxes in our shoes. And if they were hereditary, we would not be able to reverse them.
Mm.
In fact, that's probably what got me so passionate about my own work currently. I had bunions on both of my feet when I was, ironically, learning how to fix them surgically.
Right.
And about eight to 10 times a week, we're taking a scalpel and a saw, and we're opening up these people's feet. And one of the components of that operation that bothered me and why I didn't ever have one on myself was we literally cut a very important muscle off of the big toe as a component of the operation. That's called the adductor hallucis muscle. And after watching us cut that off of there hundreds and hundreds of times, I got to thinking about maybe we can stretch that muscle. Maybe we don't need to take a scalpel to it. And that's about the same time I read the work of Dr. William Rossi, which I would encourage any of your audience members to read. I've got four of his articles on my website. I've paid copyright privileges. You're more than welcome to reproduce them.
Mm.
And in fact, I have to give credit to Dr. Rossi because what I'm sharing with you and your audience today is not my work. I basically teach what he taught that was not popular during his lifetime. In fact, he wrote a bunch of books. He did several studies and largely was ignored or worse yet was made fun of.
When did he live? When was his lifetime?
Yeah, so he passed on about 10 years ago, I want to say, at about age 90, mid-90s, I think. And he's a fascinating individual because his mom and dad owned a shoe store, so he fit shoes on the weekends. They lived up above the shoe store. So early on, he saw the relationship that people have with their footwear
mm-hmm.
and how they want to present themselves in their society. Well, then he became a podiatrist, and after a year and a half, he retired because he was bored with the predictability of treating adult foot problems. So then he became a footwear industry consultant, and he consulted to a lot of kids' shoe companies and tried to get them to realize what we talked about a moment ago, which is we don't want to prop children's arches up. We want to develop them naturally.
Mm.
But that was not a very popular theme then. It's still not a popular theme these days. A lot of shoe companies charge higher prices by boasting that it's got some kind of arch developmental technology in it and so forth. So he passed on about 10 years ago, but what's really fascinating about him is the second half of his life, he studied human sociology because he couldn't understand how people could spend an hour like you and I are going to spend talking about this. It makes good sense. We can all naturally see this at birth. It's it's medically irrefutable, yet a lot of people, particularly younger people, will choose their appearance over their health.
Yeah.
And that intrigued him. So he wrote a whole bunch of articles. He wrote a whole bunch of books. He wrote a book called The Sex Life of the Shoe. It's fascinating. It talks about why we make the value decisions that we make. And that they are not about our musculoskeletal health. They oftentimes are more about beauty or social status or, in some cases, royalty, which is fascinating.
I've read some of his work. They're probably the articles you've got on your website. Could you talk about the effect on the spine or the whole skeleton that, or this is what I've learned from his work?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that was probably the feature that blew me away more than anything else on the first paper of his that I read.
Yeah.
At that time, I had a treadmill set up in the office. I was working for the orthotics lab. I was diagnosing everybody's pronation, lifting them with orthotics. But one day in the mail came one of the medical periodicals that we received called Podiatry Management. And In that journal, it had an article called "Why Shoes Make Normal Gait Impossible." And that title intrigued me because I had considered myself a gait expert. That's mostly what I studied. That's most of the medical meetings I would go to. So I thought, well, I'm going to see what this person has to say about why we can't have normal gait in our shoes. And if you look at the article, and perhaps you already have, and I hope your audience will, the diagram that he has on the front of that article is very, very telling. It's got a woman standing in her bare feet, and it shows that when we stand in our bare feet, like we're talking about, our ankles are in line with our knees, in line with our hip, in line with our shoulder, and it's just a straight line, and this is how we're built. He also showed what a body would do on a 1-inch heel, a 2-inch heel, and a 3-inch heel if we didn't make the compensatory changes that you're mentioning throughout the rest of our body. And there's two very negative changes that we make. One of them is at the level of our ankle, where we actually cause our calf muscles to become short and tight because we chronically hold them in a shortened position. But we also make some very negative and profound long-term repercussions in our core and our hips and spine. In other words, if we put on a 3-inch heel, we're not like the Leaning Tower of Pisa, that our head isn't a couple feet out in front of our body. Instead, we make these alterations and these compensations. But unfortunately, over time, those compensations and alterations are exactly what wind us up in the chiropractor office or the podiatry office. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned earlier on, Emily, it doesn't happen in the first decade of our life usually. In my practice, it's usually fourth or fifth decade, and it's usually females. And they didn't traumatize their foot, and they didn't sprain their ankle or have a hereditary influence, all of a sudden one of their feet just won't function. And we start peeling away the layers of the onion, and more often than not, they negatively alter their entire structure, like you're mentioning, for so long that our bodies will literally learn ways of moving us forward meaningfully, even if we put obstacles in their way, like shoes, or like sitting too much, or like bending your neck because you're, you know, sitting at your computer all day. All of these things are well documented to create human pathology. So you're absolutely right. We do very negative things, not just to our feet. And that's a huge misconception, that if we wear a high-heeled shoe, all we're going to do is harm our feet. You can wear a shoe that's fitted for you based on the Brannick device in the athletic category or comfort category and harm your feet and your body. So it starts early in our life. Almost all of us have done some of it, and it does catch up with us. In fact, it's really saddening to me to see somebody that doesn't get this information until they're in their sixth or seventh decade, and they've destroyed a few of their joints, and they're going in for joint replacements. Much of this stuff is preventable if we truly respected our feet. And in order to respect our feet, we have to understand how our footwear is altering them in a negative way.
Mm. When I was preparing for this interview, I came across an article on your website by Christine Kent on pelvic misalignment, and that kind of seems to, I know it's not your area of expertise, but I wondered if you could briefly talk about that.
I would be happy to. When I went to podiatry school, I had a sort of a, I guess I'll call it a podiatric-centric way of looking at things. I was focused on the feet and the ankles, and I really, well, not only was that consuming my time, there's also, in America, standard of care issues for podiatry, so or licensing limitations. So in other words, even if we were to learn about the back or the shoulder or the neck, we would never treat it. So I ended up spending an awful lot of time just really focusing on the feet and not having much interest in how our feet were affecting the rest of the body. Yeah. In the last 15 or 20 years, I've had people from all over the world contact me with the most bizarre associations with foot health and things like pelvic health and things like jaw and tooth health. I had an orthodontist from Germany who I've never ever met, did a 20-minute video documenting that if he was trying to straighten people's teeth, he noticed that their teeth got straighter if he spread their toes at the same time.
Whoa.
That's what I said. And same thing with the pelvic floor. But now that I've seen it more and more, and it makes sense why that could be. And it's kind of like what we just talked about a moment ago. People are destroying their hips and their back and their knees, but going to the orthopedic doctor who's never talking about their shoes or their feet as if they're isolated entities. So what I think it points to, Emily, is the absolute beauty of the brilliance of the architecture of our body and how wonderfully we can move and how joyfully we can live until we alter that. Mm. And once we alter that, it's a slow downhill slope. And unfortunately, the bottom of that slope is pain and suffering. And I see it all too often.
Just to change the course a little bit, what effect do different textures have on the feet? Things like walking on grass in a forest, gravel, sand, climbing on rocks.
Yeah, I've become really intrigued with that very question recently, mostly because several of my colleagues have sent me some products that they've been experimenting with. I think the very best thing for any one of us could do would be to start taking off our shoes and going outside. I run outside on concrete. It's comfortable for me because I've learned how to do it properly, and I've got strong skin and I've got strong muscles. But I would encourage even non-runners to just go outside and take your shoes off in a controlled fashion. You know, obviously don't do too much too soon. That's what gets people hurt, and that's what gets, you know, gives barefooting a bad rap. But the very first thing I would do is to start doing that. When I was learning this, my barefoot friends would tell me, as soon as you start sensing textures in the world with your feet, it's going to open up a whole new realm of possibility for you. And I absolutely agree with that. You'll actually start to crave certain textures and enjoy certain textures in your bare feet that I was not aware of until I started going barefoot. But back to your question, I was out in Boston a year ago, and I met a gentleman by the name of Dr. Stephen Bowie, who is a podiatrist from Waynesboro, Pennsylvania, who has a product called the Konex Mat. And what this is an ergonomic mat with little cones built in to stimulate the nerve endings in the bottom of your feet. I also had a podiatrist friend from New York, Dr. Emily Splickle, send me what is called Naboso, N-A-B-O-S-O, insoles, which are textured insoles which go inside of our shoes. There are a lot of studies out there that talk about the value of stimulating the sensory organs that our feet are. So I'm a huge fan of that. But rather than having to buy special things, I'm a pretty simple person, and that's why, rather than buying things, I would prefer people just go outside, walk around on your grass for a while, walk in your garden for a while, start going down the sidewalk for a few blocks. If you do it slowly in a controlled fashion, I've never heard anybody say anything other than what a joyful experience it can be. Mm. And now that we've got studies that show that it strengthens our muscles, who wouldn't want that?
Yeah. I'd like to give you a chance to caution on the need to transition to minimal footwear and barefootedness.
Mm, thank you. Yes. I was trained in podiatry school to tell people to never go barefoot. And I hear people coming into my clinic every week saying, my old podiatrist told me never go barefoot, that I need support from the moment I get out of bed. I've got to put my orthotics on. So for the audience, I think it should be known that the medical community oftentimes is trained to make that recommendation, that warning. Before I became a barefooter and started strengthening my feet, I observed that when the weather gets nice here in Portland, Oregon, people will go out to the coast, which is about an hour from Portland, and they have been wearing stiff, rigid, pointed boots during the rainy winter, not being very active. All of a sudden they go to the beach, the sun is shining, they're with their friends and their family, and they either decide to go barefoot completely or they decide to wear a flip-flop or a light sandal. Next thing you know it, they've completed 3 or 4 miles or more. They haven't been hardly walking all winter. Next week they come into my office and they tell me the bottoms of their feet hurt or some part of their body hurts. And I'm literally trained to tell them that, well, of course, you're not supposed to ever walk in your bare feet, or you're not ever supposed to walk in an unsupportive shoe. But what I realize now, and as a segue into your question, those people didn't have improper footwear. Those people had a lack of adaptation, which in our clinic we call it a training error. So it would be no different than going to the gymnasium and trying to lift your heaviest squat the very first day that you get there. You are likely to hurt something. When the book Born to Run came out in maybe 2010, and for your audience who might not be familiar, a group of runners went down to the Copper Canyons of Mexico to study this tribe of runners that runs very well into their old age. In fact, 50-year-old runners would come to the Leadville 100-mile race in America and win the whole race. And so a bunch of people went down to try to figure out Are these people eating something special? Are they using drugs to enhance their performance? Or what is enabling them to perform at such a high level? And as the book indicates, these people never alter their natural anatomy of their feet. They always keep their heel bone level with the front of their foot. Their toes are all spread. Their arch muscles are thick and strong. But when that book came out, it became very popular here in America. And unfortunately, there was not a sufficient warning attached to the recommendations. And so people went from the big, stiff, heavy shoe to either completely barefoot or in a huarache sandal or in a more minimal shoe. But they continued at their present level of activity. And unfortunately, almost immediately, a lot of those people got hurt. So whether it be your audience members are going to start doing a little bit more barefoot activity, or whether or not they decide to look at what I like to call natural footwear or natural shoes. I don't really like the term minimal shoes, because a lot of minimal shoes aren't shaped like our natural feet should be. So I prefer the term natural. And we do have a link on our site about transitioning not only into your athletic footwear, but transitioning into day-to-day footwear as well. Because the greatest successes that we see in our clinic are in people that not only choose to position themselves naturally during their sporting activities and their athletic events, we see the greatest success in people that decide that this is going to be a lifestyle for them. They're going to spend all day, every day, once they get used to it, in a natural shoe. Mm. And it's so profound to see how healing that is, and how few of those people need to come back and see me and get medicines and get shots. And certainly I hardly ever operate on anybody anymore. If people pursue their natural foot anatomy, they don't really need it. So the real problem with the adaptation formula is that everybody listening to this is unique in many different ways. So it would depend upon features like how old they are, what is their current footwear that they're wearing in terms of heel heights and rigidity and cushioning. How active are they? Are they currently running 50 miles a week, or are they not active at all? But basically, the word of caution would be to go way slower than what our body and our mind will tell us. In fact, my friend Michael Sandler, who wrote Barefoot Walking and Barefoot Running, has a rule where he recommends the very first day that you go out into your barefoot journey, you only go 200 yards or 200 meters, because your skin will allow you to damage it before it actually alerts you to that. So although there's not one formula, I think the thing to do is to just counsel people to take way more time than what they think they should. I always encourage people to think of it as lifestyle medicine. So it's not like a physical therapy program where you have to do a certain amount this day and then a certain amount more the next day. Because each natural shoe that you choose will also be a little bit different to your body. So I know that's kind of a vague answer, Emily. I wish I was able to be more specific, but it really is the most important thing to avoid if you're not going to get hurt from barefooting or natural footwear, is to just go slow.
Mm. So because children haven't endured decades of wearing damaging footwear, do they need to go through transition, or is it kind of like what you say, it's a case by case, everyone's unique?
Yeah, it's case by case. If the kids have been largely barefoot most of their life, or in more minimal, flexible, natural type shoes, then they're not going to need that transition period.
Right.
It's usually, here's an irony of what we're talking about, Emily. It's not the younger people that want to do this, and it's not them that have the problem with it. It's the older people who have failed decades of treatments and orthotics and surgeries. But ironically, those are the people that are actually going to need the most guidance, and it's going to take the most time to get them healthy in that barefoot state.
Yeah. What, have you done anything like special, or what have you done with your own daughters to allow their feet to develop naturally?
Yeah, well, fortunately for me, they allowed me to influence them all the way up until high school for my older daughter. She's a sophomore now, and my younger daughter's in eighth grade. As you maybe can imagine and probably have witnessed in your own country, and maybe even in your own life when you're a teenager, we are concerned with our appearance, or we are concerned with what our peers observe us to be wearing and whether it's cool or not. And where my daughters go to school, the skateboarding shoes Vans are very popular.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're at the mall and they say, Daddy, we got to have Vans. You know, that's the cool shoes. And so we take out the sock liner and I have them stand on it, and they see that it's not healthy for their feet. So we make a bargain. I try to have them wear them as infrequently as possible, be barefoot all the time at home. Whenever they're in athletic activities, I try to make sure they get into natural footwear. But my daughter and I, my younger daughter and I, sat out on our driveway about 6 years ago, probably, and she was playing soccer at the time. And there's no soccer shoe that's shaped like a natural human foot to this day.
Nice.
So I went out and I bought her two brands that had the wider options, and I bought them a little bit big. But within a week, she got ingrown toenails on both of her big toes.
Wow.
And I'm trained to tell people, well, you're cutting your toenails wrong. That's why you're getting ingrown toenails. But instead, what we did is we sat down on the driveway. We pulled the sock liners out of her Adidas soccer cleats and out of her Nike soccer cleats, and we had her stand on them. And at this point, her feet are still healthy and natural, and her feet are still widest at the tips of the toes. But the video is pretty telling in terms of what those cleats were doing to her healthy feet every time she went out to play. But this is what we've been enduring for the last many hundreds of years. And I'm working with several groups of dedicated people to try to change the way we do things, mostly so that we can prevent things from happening rather than waiting until they happen, waiting until someone's in their fourth or fifth decade and they've already harmed themselves significantly.
This kind of, you know, this segued into my next question, which was, here in New Zealand, most schools have compulsory school uniform with school shoes, which are definitely not, you know, natural shoes. And then also most sports require the children to wear the same sort of thing. Is there something that can be done to help minimize that sort of damage when they're obligated to wear that footwear?
There is, Emily. I'm sorry, I keep saying you're from Australia. Now that you clarified you're from New Zealand.
Okay.
Before I answer that, I was told that about 50% of the population in New Zealand does go barefoot. Is that true?
Yep, there's definitely a lot of us would be bare feet. I would agree with that, having traveled to a lot of other countries.
Awesome to hear. Mm. So yes, when we have people coming in who either are in a sport that doesn't have a natural selection, or worse yet, are sponsored by a company that doesn't have a natural selection. So I'm where Nike headquarters are. So I see the Nike Olympians, I see the Nike employees, I see their spouses, and they have a culture where they require their athletes to wear their footwear. And obviously they're paying a lot of these athletes big dollars to wear their footwear. So for instance, when the London 2012 Olympics came around, I had a handful of distance runners with a variety of foot problems. And so we modified their Nike running spikes. And so the simple things, like if it has a sock liner in the spike, we take that out and remove it. That automatically gives a little bit more volume. We take a scalpel to people's shoes the way I used to take a scalpel to people's feet. And we actually alter the footwear to be more closely aligned with what their natural anatomy would be. So these are lacing changes. These are making little cuts. These are stretching. So until we have good, natural, healthy footwear for all the athletic activities we love to do, we're going to have to do what we call shoe surgery. And we've got videos on our website too, these various techniques, if your audience would like to try some of these things. But my dream come true, my hope for my career, is that before I go to the grave, that there are natural athletic shoes for every athletic endeavor that people enjoy doing.
That'd be great. Do you see many children in your practice?
I see probably 10 to 20% are children.
Mm-hmm.
In one case in particular, I love, and I think we've got either a blog post or a photograph that points to what we're talking about here. I had a mother and father bring a child in. He was probably 3.5, and they had taken him to one of my colleagues who noticed that he had overlapping toes, also known as hammer toes.
Mm-hmm.
And my colleague offered to do for him what I was trained to do, which is take him to the operating room, put him to sleep, cut open the tops of his toes, release tendons and cut bones, and then put pins in. And obviously, any parent isn't going to like the sound of that, so they didn't. And they heard that we do more natural work, so they came by. And as I mentioned at the outset of our time together, the very first thing we do is show the baby footprint, talk about the footwear, talk about the inherent shortcomings of the Brannock device. But before I got to the point of pulling the child's sock liner out so mom and dad could see why he was getting crooked toes, the father interrupted me and he said, "This doesn't have anything to do with his shoes. This runs in our family."
Mm-hmm.
I've got it. His uncle has it. His grandpa has it. And so I didn't say another word. I just reached in, pulled the sock liner out, put it under the child's foot, and dad and mom collectively went, oh, because I showed them something that most people are not seeing. Mm. And if you don't see it, you're going to violate yourself by going by feel. In other words, a lot of people will say they can move their toes inside of their toe box, but what they really mean is they can move them up and down. They can't really spread them. So we put correct toes on that child. We got the child into footwear that was shaped like his natural foot. In a year and a half, his left foot was completely cured. Wow. One of the proudest moments of my career. And his right foot was almost completely cured. This is several years ago, so I'm convinced he is cured now. I'll never see him. Nobody else is ever going to cut his toes.
Wow.
So those are kind of success stories I want people to know about, because there are people being operated on, including children, that really could cure themselves with a much more natural, cost-effective program. But it does require you to wear shoes shaped like natural feet.
Yeah. I'm so impressed that upon reading William Rossi's work, you were so open to completely changing your viewpoint of everything you were taught. I'm thankful because now you're here to share it all with us. Is there anything that, any practices that you did as a podiatrist prior to learning all of this that you now regret or wouldn't do again?
Everything?
Yeah.
do you have another hour, Emily? Oh, geez, I'm not kidding. I would say I don't use a lot of medicines with my patients anymore, at least not pharmaceutical medicines. I used to prescribe a lot of anti-inflammatories. I used to take a lot of anti-inflammatories, pain medicines. I don't prescribe those or take them myself. I would have told you as recently as 3 years ago that if you had a soft tissue injury that you should put ice on it. I no longer recommend ice after reading the book Iced by Gary Steinle. Mm-hmm. I don't stretch pre-runs anymore like I used to. Oh, I could just go on and on and on. Certainly, I don't make rigid orthotics for the majority of people. Instead, I strengthen them. Mm-hmm. I try not to tolerate conventional footwear. I used to believe that people that were working at shoe stores knew how to, or shoe companies knew about feet, but they really don't. They're designers is essentially what they are.
Yeah.
So I would strongly discourage people from just walking into a shoe store, being put on the treadmill and thinking that you're going to come up with some valuable information. So literally I have to stay humble because I have made an about face change in almost everything I do. But I would also say, Emily, it's been for the better though. You know, I may not make as much money, which is fine. I may not see as many people a day, which is fine. But the successes that we have are just overwhelmingly gratifying. Nothing makes me happier than seeing somebody get back out into the activity that they love. Because if I can't do what I love, I probably would have to take pharmaceutical medicines. So to be able to enable people to live in their body healthfully and naturally is the greatest gift that I've been given.
Well, that's great. My son's GP told me when he was 13 months old that he needed to start wearing shoes for ankle support. Mm. So needless to say, we never went back to her again. But unfortunately, you know, many people take their doctor's word as gospel. You know, why is this information not more widely known in the medical community?
I think there's several reasons for that. One reason I think I've learned is when good information comes to the medical community in particular, there have been some speculation about how long it's going to take for it to be implemented. So that's one thing. And that's not just about foot health. That's, I could tell you stories about things that we used to do that we no longer do. But even when the credible information came out, it took us a long, long time. For instance, stomach ulcers being caused by bacteria instead of stress. Or, you know, so we don't give acid blockers anymore. We give an antibiotic. I think probably the more profound, relevant influence that I don't think is going to go away anytime soon is it's a huge undertaking physically and financially to pursue a medical degree. And not so surprisingly, most people don't have abundant wealth and they're coming out with large student loans. And up until recently, the typical podiatrist or orthopedic surgeon is probably going to be in private practice, which means they've got a huge overhead. And I'm not saying these people are bad people. I'm just saying there is a economic reality to how much you have to generate to just keep your doors open. And if there were one downside of the work that I do and what I've shared with you guys today, it doesn't make money. Mm. For instance, if I excuse me, if I talk one of my podiatry colleagues into selling correctos in their clinic, they're going to make $30. But they're going to have to spend about an hour convincing that patient why the last time they've talked to them about their pronation and their arch support, now they're going to steer them in the opposite direction. So there's many layers to it. I'll also say this. Podiatry in New Zealand, I've come to understand, is somewhat different than in America, maybe not quite as surgically oriented as I've understood. But the reality about podiatry in America that some people are not familiar with until we talk about it is podiatry is an allopathic branch of medicine. So for the audience who may not be familiar with the different branches of medicine, you've got the osteopathic branch of medicine. These are the DOs, the doctors of osteopathy, who used to function more like chiropractors, now function more like the MDs, the allopaths, also known as the medical doctors. You've also got the chiropractors. You've got the naturopathic medicine. But podiatry has always aspired to be an allopathic branch of medicine. And so what the audience should be thinking about there is when you go to your allopath, you're going to get a treatment. You're going to get a prescription. You're going to get, you know, some form of medical treatment likely. And in podiatry, it's no different. In podiatry, we're trained that if we can make the symptoms go away, that equates to health and wellness versus reading Dr. Rossi and hanging out with a lot more naturally minded providers. I've come to the realization that we also want to look at prevention, and we also want to address problems before they arise. And that's not what podiatry does. Podiatry is a treatment-based allopathic profession that tries to make the pain go away. And that's not a bad thing. It's just that that's an incomplete system. What I'm trying to get podiatry to do is to layer in the prevention and the education no matter what, so that if people do need treatment down the road, they're going to do better after their treatment by pursuing principles that could have prevented them from having to have the treatment to begin with.
Mm. I keep coming across the same viewpoint, which is kind of like what you've just said, where, you know, anything from nutritional guidelines to skincare to dental health, even mattresses for sleeping, there's this widespread shared delusion that because the big name companies or corporations use the best experts and the best scientific minds, then these natural approaches, they're seen as anti-science almost.
Yeah.
Do you have something to say to that?
Yeah. Oh, I absolutely, I see it. And I've had lots of conversations. I especially get the conversation here locally, since Nike is headquartered here, Adidas is headquartered here, Keen and so forth. And these companies are all telling the message that you and I are learning isn't the healthful message, that you want to have arch support and cushioning and stability and ankle support and so forth. But for years, maybe not so much more recently, simply because the medical literature is actually showing these things to be true, but for years, the Nike person or the athlete would come in and I would give them my spiel and they would say, well, how could you be right when this whole behemoth of a company is doing things exactly the opposite of what you just told me is helpful? Mm. So you're absolutely right. There is this mentality that if the majority are doing it, then it's what's right. But you mentioned in the pre-show email too about another favorite doctor of mine, Dr. Weston Price.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing. You know, it's fact, if you have a moment for a quick story,
yep.
You know, I have the same conversation every day with people coming in. Here's what the standard should be. Here's how we get you there. And one day I had this lady looking at me and listening intently. And she said, you know what? The way you speak about feet sounds exactly to me like how Dr. Weston Price talked about teeth and jawbones and palates and so forth. So she brought me his book, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration.
Mm-hmm.
And I devoured it, and it blew my mind because, to your point, here's a guy in dentistry that's like Rossi was in podiatry and probably countless others. Well, I could name people in nutrition right now that are getting beat up over actual science because the majority are not pursuing actual science. But after I read some of Dr. Price's work, I went to my own dentist and I said, what do you think about Weston Price? And he literally looked at me and he said, who? And that's what the average podiatrist would say if I brought up Rossi, who? William used to write to the podiatry schools every year and ask them just add a little bit more natural foot health curriculum.
Mm.
It didn't happen. So it's the way I see the world now, I am actually more suspicious of the majority viewpoint. than I am the minority, because it seems like every rabbit hole I go down, whether it's nutrition or feet or teeth or core or whatever posture, it seems like it is oftentimes the outliers. In fact, in medicine, it's quite compelling to notice that changes that occur don't ever change by the majority making the change. It's usually a few outliers that influence for maybe 15 or 20 years, and then the change eventually gets embraced. So it's frustrating.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up about Weston Price. That was going to be my next question. Can you tell us about correct toes?
You bet. So as I mentioned earlier, I was doing a lot of bunion operations, and it's common to do a bunion and a hammer toe operation at the same time, since they oftentimes go hand in hand. And on both of my feet, I had both of those. So my second toe sat up on top of my big toe on both of my feet, and my body hurt like crazy all the time. Feet hurt, knees hurt, back hurt. So I read Dr. Rossi. I spent some time with some physical therapists in a nursing home watching their manual work that they do for people that were immobile or stiff. And I decided to start putting a single silicone spacer between my big toe and my second toe on both of my feet. And I started stretching my big toes back into their natural alignment. And I started wearing the only shoes available at that time in America that would allow me to do that were Crocs. Birkenstock might have allowed it too, but it wasn't an athletic shoe. So I did all of my running in Crocs. I ran my best marathon in a pair of Crocs.
Wow.
But what I noticed, it was fascinating. And not only that, I ran the next day, which is not common for me after a marathon. And that's when I really said to myself, the reason why people hurt so bad after a marathon is poor technique, poor nutrition, and poor footwear.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we can address all three of those, you can run joyfully for miles and miles and miles. I lost my train of thought there for a moment.
Sorry. Running in Crocs?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. So I got these Crocs, and I'm putting a single silicone between my first and second toe. And over the course of several months, I noticed that my toe was getting straighter, which all of my podiatry colleagues told me could not happen. And then I started putting one between my fourth and fifth toes. And my fifth toe used to sit completely under my fourth toe. You couldn't see it because I wore really tight running spikes.
Yeah.
Well, I got pretty excited about this because my body started feeling better. I started recovering better from my running, started running a little bit faster. And so most of my patients are runners or hikers or walkers. So I started talking to them about this. And most of them were very intrigued by this. Most of them were highly bothered by the fact that there were no nice looking shoes to do this. But the brave ones and the ones that cared more about their health and more about their function started running in Crocs like I did. And we started using single silicone splints. And the results were nothing shy of remarkable. But the downside was many things. The biggest downside was that the single silicone splints would not stay in place. So we'd get out on a run, our foot would start to perspire and the silicone would get a little soft, and then it would start extruding out from between the toes. So I was out on a mountain bike ride one day with a buddy of mine who's a designer, and I just started describing my problem to him, and we got together and we made, we made the one piece correct toes. And that was, 2002, maybe 2003, I'm thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so my first prototype was actually for my own feet again, just to see if I could hold them in the natural position long enough to where they maintained that, and they did, and they still do. Unfortunately, I made a mistake early on with the early prototype, and I used to think that all of our toes needed to be spaced away from each other, and I don't believe that anymore. I think it's mostly the fifth toe needs to get away from the fourth, and the big toe needs to get away from the second. So I actually ruptured one of the collateral ligaments on my fourth toe of my left foot. So I joke with my friends and family oftentimes about how life is a series of learning from mistakes, and that was one of them. But we eventually did get the durometer, the softness of the material the way we wanted, and we got the structure of the product the way we wanted. And now we've actually got four different sizes, from extra small, small, medium, and large. Most people fit into the medium, men and women. But it's been a fun journey to just see people changing their feet alignment very much like we change our teeth and jaw alignment with simple things like we have a product here in America called Invisalign.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you guys use it over there. So most people would look at that probably and say, how in the world are you going to change jawbone, or how are you going to move enamel? But progressively applied force frequently will do just that. Human body is remarkably malleable.
Mm.
So that's the backstory. And it's my favorite thing to do now is to non-surgically rehabilitate somebody.
Cool. Can I ask, since orthotics, they're not allowing the foot to remold itself by regaining its strength. How are correct toes different?
Yeah. So what correct toes do is they actually put all of the toe bones into the alignment that is intended for us. And the reason why that's different, the reason why that's beneficial is if you do a deep dive on the anatomy of the foot and the lower leg, it's very compelling to notice how much of all of the muscles and all of the tendons from the knee on down attach on the last toe bone. Mm. Whereas you're going to see from the video I mentioned earlier, pronation versus overpronation, you're able to see how when we don't use the best position for that last toe bone, the muscles and tendons pulling on those toe bones aren't going to do what they're supposed to do. So then the arch is going to collapse. Correspondingly, if you look at our feet as a tensegrity system, and I hope the audience is somewhat familiar with that, it's basically this idea that compression and tension forces are supposed to exist concurrently. And so by taking that last toe bone, that distal phalanx, we call it, of each of the toes, putting it back into its natural alignment, that's what enables the foot to actually get strong.
I'm just looking at my feet while we're talking. So my little toe is the only one that has that kind of turned in. I kind of ignore my little toe, but I see now that, or like you're saying, there's so many joints that connect to it. So I guess it would be quite useful for me to maybe work on trying to encourage a gap in between that one and my fourth toe.
Can I send you some correct toes?
Oh, yes, please. I'd love some. Thank you.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. You bet. So maybe after we speak, you could just drop me an email with your address and I'll send you a complimentary pair.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Are there any misconceptions about children's foot development that we haven't covered today?
I don't think any that we didn't cover. The one that we did cover, I think, is the overwhelming one, which is they don't need to be supported. In fact, you're probably going to harm the development of the child by supporting them. And if there are times when they're probably going to need to be covered, but just make it a covering and not a overly supportive, overly cushioned, heavy covering. And these days are good days to live as far as kids' footwear is concerned. I got several companies. Splay is an awesome company. Another company out of Brazil, Tiptoey Joey, I've been working closely with them. So there's lots of good companies out there now for kids' footwear. I should also mention, too, to your audience, one of the articles that Dr. Rossi has on our website is called Children's Footwear, Launching Site for Adult Foot Ills. And that's where Dr. Rossi makes the compelling point that we talked about today, which is we start deforming our natural anatomy probably by about age 2 or 3, at least here in America, and probably many people in New Zealand are doing the same.
Yeah. All right. Well, I will put links in the show notes to all of the resources we've discussed today. Is there anywhere else people can go to find out more about what we've talked about today or to get in contact with you?
You bet. So we've got a Correct Toes website, www.correcttoes.com. Mm-hmm. We've got a whole bunch of articles and studies for people that want to look at some of the literature that we talked about today. I've got probably 85 videos on YouTube. So if your audience wanted to click in anything on YouTube, Ray McClanahan Bunions or Ray McClanahan Neuroma, or, you know, they're going to find short, succinct, 5-minute videos focusing on the elements of that particular entity. Our hope really is that people can educate themselves, get what they need, and actually heal themselves without even having to go to the doctor.
Mm, that's great. Ray, I'm so pleased you agreed to speak with me today. I hope the listeners get as much out of this interview as I have. Do you have any final words of wisdom you'd like to end on?
Yeah, I think the thing I want your audience to take away more than anything is how important the fit of the shoe is. And since it's as important as I've seen it to be, I would encourage your audience to employ the sock liner test that we talked about. Of anything that I've learned about feet, I think if people can actually visualize how their feet are positioned inside of their shoe, it's very, very eye-opening for many people. And for most people, it directs them to choosing healthier options.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.